America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. There is a powerful piece by Paul Kanger, friend of this show, the senior director of the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College. Powerful piece that takes a look at how the observance of the 20th anniversary of 9/11 contrasted the United States of America and our enemies. And then there's another revelation, to me at least, that I found out about recently, partially because of Paul Kanger, that has to do with a revelation about another figure in the news. We're talking about Sirhan Sirhan. It's not that he killed Robert Kennedy. I think every reasonable person knows that and acknowledges it. Something else about his background and motivation, which we will get to. It's always a pleasure to speak to Paul Kanger. He is a prolific author and one of the best thinkers around. And he just wrote a column which is coming out soon. I think it's coming out, the column about Massawi and what he testified in his trial, 2006. When does that column appear, Paul?
Yeah. Hey, Michael. Yeah, it'll run in the Pittsburgh paper. So I have a column every other week for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. That'll run Thursday, and it's called Us Versus Them. And, yeah, what Zacharias Massawi said to U.S. Attorney Robert Spencer March 23rd, 2006,
This is one of the conspirators
awful.
For 9/11.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right. And, in fact, Spencer said to him, he said, "You told the jury that you have no regrets for your part in this." And Massawi said, here's an exact quote, "I just wish it will happen on the 12th, the 13th, the 14th, the 15th, the 16th, the 17th, and I could go on and on. There is no remorse for justice." And when Spencer said to him, he said, "What about the chilling testimony that you heard from the Pentagon victims?" He said, "It made me smile," Massawi said, and he said, "I would have even laughed if I didn't know that it would have got me kicked out of the court." He said it was his pleasure to hear all of it. Made his day, he said. Made his day.
And one of the points you make in your column, which is very powerful, is what a contrast that was from the United States, where from the very beginning, President Bush led this country in trying to make sure that this horrible thing that had been done to us and the death of 3,000 Americans would not lead to prejudice against peaceful Muslim citizens and our neighbors and, in many cases, friends. That's not the same attitude that Massawi and other al-Qaeda plotters actually expressed, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, I remember because I did a book on the faith of George W. Bush called God and George W. Bush. I think it came out around 2005, 2006. And I had a chapter in there, Michael, where I quoted George W. Bush talking about Islam after 9/11. And there were complaints about Christians who said, "He sounds like a Muslim," right? I mean, Bush was saying that Islam is a religion of peace, that Muslims don't want death, that what the suicide bombers did is not real Islam, it's a distortion of the Quran. I mean, Bush was very kind, very, very charitable. But you contrast Massawi's attitude and Osama bin Laden. And Osama bin Laden had said back in February 1998, he said, "Kill Americans wherever and wherever you find them." And the Americans didn't have to be soldiers. I mean, this could be men, women, young, old. This could be Marines. This could be babies. And I contrast that to, indeed, how Americans value life. And I gave the example that from our college president, Paul McNulty, last week gave a speech in Pittsburgh. And he talked about how of the 2,800 people who were crushed under the rubble of the World Trade Center buildings, we only found remains of about 1,100 people. And he said that each and every time, Michael, that those remains were found at the wreckage site, the entire place paused. Everybody stood in order. Everyone bowed their heads. Everyone was silent. And they slowly carried out, almost ceremoniously, right, almost like a religious service, they carried all those remains away from ground zero. And it just showed the kind of Judeo-Christian understanding that those were all people made in the image of God, the Imago Dei, the image of God. And the contrast there between how we respect life in America and our Western values and how the 9/11 hijackers and Musawi view life, you know, the contrast couldn't be more clear.
And no, the contrast is very striking, and it also made me think of this, Paul, and I'm speaking of Paul Kengor, who is the head of the senior director for the Indispensable Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College, and just outside in Grove City, Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh. I was going to mention this to you, is that we're all looking back for over 20 years. And, of course, one of the big surprises over these 20 years is that there was no follow-on attack that they were able to launch. We know they wanted to, but right, that our counterterror forces and deployments and efforts did such a spectacularly successful job. But there was something else that everybody expected, particularly on the left. Do you remember how right after 9/11, we were told we had to watch out for this huge upsurge in anti-Muslim acts of terror and hatred and intolerance here in the United States? That never happened.
Exactly right. Yep.
That just didn't happen, right?
It didn't happen. Yeah, they weren't marched off to internment camps, right, like the Japanese under FDR, right, in the 1940s. And a lot of that, I mean, that was George W. Bush's leadership response. And in fact, it's quite the contrary. He talked about Islam so glowingly. He wouldn't even say things like, well, you know, it does say in the Quran that, you could strike off the head of the believer on the battlefield and so forth. I mean, Bush didn't do any of that. You know, Bush said things like the Quran teaches peace, the Quran teaches tolerance. And on your other point, one of the reasons why we never did have another attack, I saw Mark Thiessen, who was a Bush speechwriter, make this point just a couple weeks ago, Michael. He said, because we've been in Afghanistan since 2001, and our military, we've kept our boots on their necks. We've kept Afghanistan from becoming the hornet's nest of Islamists and terrorists that it was under the Taliban from 1996 to 2001. When Osama said what he said in February 1998, he said that from a Taliban-controlled sanctuary in Afghanistan. And unfortunately, we're now going back to a situation where it's not only back to 9/11 with the Taliban in control, but I would argue, Michael, that is even worse than where we were in September 11, 2001, because in September 11, 2001, Al-Qaeda didn't exist. ISIS didn't exist. There was no such thing as ISIS-K like there is now in Afghanistan. So we're not only back to where we were, you know, ground zero in the original 9/11, I think we're in an even worse position than we were in 9/11. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to make a partisan comment, but I've got to lay this at the feet of Joe Biden and this horrible withdrawal that he and his administration have completely botched over the last few weeks.
Completely botched, and a demonstration of indelible incompetence. Can you hang on for a few more moments? I want to talk to you about the dirty little secret about Sirhan Sirhan. People on this show know it because I mentioned it last week, but most Americans have no idea. But you're going to find out moments from now with Dr. Paul Kengor of Grove City College and the great Institute for Faith and Freedom coming up. On the mic. that show. Okay, I'm here minding my own business. I'm doing my show. I'm talking to my friend, my longtime friend, Professor Paul Kangor of Grove City College and Senior Director of the Institute for Faith and Freedom. And this just comes up on my screen. Breaking news, the Capitol Police, you remember them, they have arrested a man with a machete and a bayonet in a pickup truck painted with a swastika near Democratic National Committee headquarters. U.S. Capitol Police arrested a man who had banned weapons in a truck near Democratic National Committee headquarters. The vehicles had swastikas and other white supremacist symbols painted on it, according to the department. I wonder what the other symbols were. I'm sure we'll find out. The arrest came less than a week before people were set to gather at the Capitol for another rally in support of the hundreds who have been jailed in connection with the deadly January 6th Capitol riot. Reaction, Paul Kangor?
Yeah, what a nice guy. What a sweetheart, right? That's not the kind of guy that I want my daughter to bring home. Yeah, that's,
right, well,
that's pretty nasty.
But it relates a little bit to Sirhan Sirhan because he was, again, I mean, people knew at the time, and I remember because, of course, I was there at the Kennedy assassination. Found out about him was that he was Jordanian originally, because when he was born, a part of Jerusalem in which his family was born was part of Jordan, and a mandatory Palestine, as they used to say. In any event, Sirhan Sirhan was not only a dangerous and awful human being, and not only profoundly anti-Semitic and a great hater of everything Israeli, but what else did most Americans never find out about him?
Yeah, the fact that he was a communist, and you know, in that sense, it's ironic, because of course, so is Lee Harvey Oswald, who shot RFK's brother JFK, and we've had for 50 years almost Sirhan Sirhan's diaries, and he wrote things in there like, "My determination to eliminate RFK has become an unshakable obsession. He must be killed. He must be assassinated. He must be assassinated before June 5th, 1968." We know that. But he also wrote "Long Live Communism," and he wrote it over and over again. He tended to do that in these pages. He would write things over and over again, and he wrote, "I firmly support the communist cause and its people, whether Russian, Chinese, Albanian, Hungarian, or whoever." And he quoted the final words of the Communist Manifesto: "Workers of the world, unite! You have nothing to lose but your chains and a world to win." So communism was part of his motivation, and that's ironic, Michael, because it was Sirhan Sirhan shot RFK on the 1 year anniversary of the Six Day War, and that was because of RFK's support of Israel during the Six Day War, and that war was actually precipitated. A lot of people don't know this, but it was precipitated by Soviet disinformation, misinformation, Soviet agitation with Egypt and the other Arab states to try to spark a regional conflict in the Middle East in June 1967, and they did. They sparked it. So, so in more than one way, communism, the Soviets, and also in the sense of Sirhan Sirhan's support of communism, communism played a role in this.
Well, you see, again, you also mentioned in passing that, and of course it's true, that Lee Harvey Oswald was a communist. He was such an enthusiastic communist, he defected to Russia after serving in the U.S. Marine Corps.
They called him Oswaldovich. His Marine Corps buddies, they made fun of him. Yeah, yeah.
Well, again, so he was probably angry, secretly angry at his Marine Corps, but look, he was deeply, deeply disturbed and insane individual.
Yeah, yeah.
And
right.
But what's interesting about that is part of the history of the Warren Commission is President Johnson was very concerned to play down Oswald's communist connection. because he was afraid it would provoke some kind of confrontation with or would inflame anti-communist elements in the United States. And it may be that the same kind of thing was operating because, of course, Johnson was still president with Kennedy. If he had those diaries from RFK, the president of the United States, he may not have wanted people to focus on the fact that he was a communist.
Well, that's right. And also, in fact, I have a lot on this in my book, A Pope and a President. When the Soviets learned that Lee Harvey Oswald had those Soviet connections, those Russian connections. In fact, who was it? Kalugin, I think, was the Soviet former KGB guy. He talked a lot about this once he defected to the U.S. They were apoplectic. They were terrified that this was going to immediately implicate Moscow, the Kremlin, in the JFK assassination. And they immediately began sending out information, trying to distance themselves from Oswald. They even created misinformation, disinformation, trying to allege that Oswald was working for the CIA. So they were doing everything that they possibly could. But Johnson was afraid of that perception. RFK was afraid of it. And Jackie Kennedy, of all things, Jackie Kennedy later made this comment about, how ridiculous that my husband was killed by a silly little communist, right? Yeah, she was hoping that it was something more glorious, like a civil rights issue, right? But no, he was killed by the silly little communist. Well, you know, Oswald was anything but a silly little communist. He was a dangerous little communist, and it was communism that motivated him, just like Sirhan at least had, I don't know about communist motivation in the shooting of RFK, but he was supportive of communism.
Okay, let me ask you something else, because I was speaking before on this issue of all of the controversy that we go through on everything right now in our country, including getting a vaccine to save lives, at everything. I know there are serious people who believe that part of this is provoked, just the controversy aspect of it, by Russian disinformation. And you're somebody who's written about Russian disinformation going back 60, 70 years. Do you think that continues to be a threat to our country?
Oh, constantly. In fact, the Russian word is desinformatsiya. You know, they had actual policies of disinformation. They had Soviet, they were called active measures campaigns. They had a department of agitprop. So they specialized in this. And, you know, I would think that the Russians, I must call them Soviets, it would be nothing for them to get involved in the 2016 election, the 2020 election, the 2024 election. They like to foment disinformation. And Putin is an old KGB guy.
Yes,
so this
of course
is something
he is.
Done for decades, yeah.
And people can get perspective on this by checking out some of Paul Kengor's latest books and columns and all the latest activities at the Faith and Freedom Institute at Grove City College. We'll be right back on the MedVed Show. Michael Medved Show, one of the things that Americans are looking for, I mean, I really do believe that most Americans want something like consensus, something you can agree on, so that not every single thing is a bitter to the death controversy, because you can't win all those struggles. But if you reach consensus on some things, well, then everybody can win. This is a story where, honest to goodness, by the way, if somebody disagrees with this, if there's somebody who's not part of the consensus, I dare you to call me up. 1-800-955-1776. Story from Associated Press. The U.S. has just doubled fines for travelers on airplanes who break mask rules. 1-800-955-1776. The United States is doubling the fine for people who break the rule requiring masks on airplanes and other forms of public transit to slow the spread of COVID-19, with President Biden warning that violence violators should be prepared to pay. First-time offenders would face a potential fine of $500 to $1,000. Second-time offenders could pay $1,000 to $3,000 under rules that the Transportation Security Administration said will go into effect. They've actually gone into effect. They were supposed to go into effect on Friday. The fine currently starts at $250 and can go up to $1,500 for repeat offenders. Now, I was reading this and I was saying, how often can this possibly happen? I mean, honest to goodness, I know masks are really, really annoying. But in an airplane, you're locked in a sealed metal tube, sometimes for hours at a time. And those seats put you pretty darn close. And do the masks actually save lives? They probably do. But even if they don't, they make me feel better. Our daughter, who lives in New York, comes home from time to time, visits. That means going on an airplane. And yes, I'm concerned. She was concerned because she was sitting not too far away from somebody who did get into trouble because he refused to put on a mask. And the problem here is not just refusing to put on a mask, it's the conflicts that follow. If you break the rules, be prepared to pay, Biden said as he announced the increase. The president also rebuked people who have been taking out their anger about the mask requirement on flight crews. He says, and by the way, show some respect, he said. The anger you see on television toward flight attendants and others doing their jobs is just wrong. It's ugly. The FAA said last month that airlines have reported, okay, please sit down wherever you are. How many incidents involving unruly passengers this year? 3,889. Now, some of them are just standard people, drink too much, they behave badly, they might light up a cigarette in the bathroom. But of those 3,889 incidents, most of them involve masking. 2,867. 74% of all unruly passenger institutes involve masking. Really? Has it come to this? Is this something that that makes a great deal of sense in terms of the greatest country in the world? The mask order, which is based on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines for responding to the pandemic, was first issued on January 29th, days after Biden took office. Before that, airlines had their own requirements for face coverings, but former President Donald Trump's administration had declined to make it a federal rule. Well, now it's a federal rule. Something wrong with that about while you're riding on a plane? And again, the idea that Americans are going to fight over absolutely everything. There's a piece, and it's very interesting, and it has a couple of surprising perspectives. It's basically the headline comes up and it's by Nate Cohn from the Upshot section of the New York Times, news analysis, as they call it. Symbol of the U.S. political rift this century, a college degree. And they bring up the fact that when you talk about skirmishes that divide people in a very bitter way, they argue that these skirmishes may be different in substance from those that preceded them in years past. But in the broadest sense, they are only the latest manifestation of a half-century trend. The realignment of American politics along cultural and educational lines and away from the class and income divisions that divided the two parties for much of the 20th century. For much of the 20th century, it used to be the Republican Party was a party of the middle class. the Democratic Party was a party of the super duper upper crust and then poor people. Today, as they've grown in numbers, college graduates have instilled increasingly liberal cultural norms while gaining the power to nudge the Democratic Party to the left. As I say, further than nudge, I'd say shove. Partly as a result, large portions of the party's traditional working class base have defected to the Republicans. Now, what does this mean? There are Democrats who chime in commenting on this article and this observation. Biden won 60% of the vote for college graduates. And back in 1960, when Richard Nixon ran against John Kennedy, even though John Kennedy was obviously someone who was very marinated in Harvard, Richard Nixon won 60% of the college graduates. Kennedy actually lost people who had a four-year college degree. So why did he win anyway? Because in that year, and it's amazing to think about, in that year, in 1960, only 5% of voters of any race had a college degree. And today, the most recent election, it was 42% had a college degree, and it's heading toward a majority because more people are going to college. The point about this that I found interesting is people are arguing about whether this is going to be a long-term trend in terms of moving the Democratic Party to the left as they're more and more based and basing their power on college graduates. And the answer that they give here is not necessarily, because, and they have the statistics to show it, is that even though in the 60s and 70s, college graduates went way to the left, they say, and again, Reagan's popularity in the late 70s through the early 90s, college graduates moved away from some of that 60s sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and you had a much better representation of conservative ideas, even coming from colleges and universities. And the New York Times at least speculates that could happen again, which is one of the reasons it's so important, I believe, to support organizations like that Institute for Faith and Freedom we were just talking about Grove City College, to support conservative alternatives in the world of higher education. When we come back, there's actually a revelation about Bill Maher. Why is he going after liberals so often now? Has he changed? We'll hear his answer coming up on the... Michael Medved Show. I'm very proud that later this week we're going to be having on the great George Will. And he was just on Bill Maher, actually, which is kind of surprising. You don't normally think of Bill Maher as a conservative. Well, he's been sounding more and more like one. Or at least he's been sounding more and more fed up with some of the extremes of the left. And the thoughtless mob psychology that sometimes frequently infects people's left-wing politically correct attitudes. Here he is with the same evening that he had George Will on with him, where he talked a little bit about why he has been attacking the left more and more. Clip 15.
When people say to me sometimes, like, boy, you know, you go after the left a lot these days. Why? I'm like, because you're embarrassing me. That's why I'm going after the left, in a way you never did before. Because you're inverting things that I'm not going to give up on being liberal. This is what these teachers are talking about, that you're taking children and making them hyper aware of race in a way they wouldn't otherwise be. I mean, I saw last night on the football game, Alicia Keys sang Lift Every Voice and Sing, which now I hear is called the Black National Anthem. Now, maybe we should get rid of our national anthem, but I think we should have one national anthem. I think when you go down a road where you're having two different national anthems, colleges sometimes now have, many of them have different graduation ceremonies for black and white, separate dorms. This is what I mean, segregation. You've inverted the idea. We're going back to that under a different name.
Okay, good for him. And the idea, by the way, the one of the points he could make on that is if we do come to the point where we have two national anthems, it won't stop with two. And there's no chance it would stop with two. Look for a gay national anthem. Look for I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, in numbers too big to ignore. You know, Helen Reddy, right? I mean, honestly, is that the direction we want to go? And then speaking with George Will, they had the following exchange. This is number 18A.
Well, Orwellian is an Orwellian used adjective, but here it applies. In 1984, Orwell said, watch the language because it becomes turned inside out. In 1984, love meant hate, war meant peace, and on campus today, diversity means enforced conformity. Because we have, through the magic of modern parenting, and isn't it interesting that parent became a verb right before this began to happen? What is happening on campus is they're giving up on the essential ingredient of democracy, which is a cultural persuasion. They've given up on the idea of persuasion, and they're going to mandate. We don't just mandate eviction moratoria, and we don't just mandate vaccinations. We now mandate harmony on campus because we've raised children to be so risk-averse and to be so convinced that they are awesome. They all got participation trophies for showing up at soccer practice. And they arrive at campus, and they want to be have a safe space to be safe from challenging ideas that might make them sad.
Look, that is, of course, spot on. And then Bill Maher mentioned a story that we had covered on the air earlier, which was the trigger warnings, the warnings of possible offense that were attached to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence at the National Archives. Listen, 18B.
You know that at Brandeis University, the phrase trigger warning now requires a trigger warning? Because warning suggests there's a danger, and trigger, well, you know what that makes people think of.
They put, the National Archives put a trigger warning now on the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence.
They have said that our documents might be harmful or difficult to review.
This is always my thing with the Democrats. If what you're doing sounds like a headline in The Onion. No, really.
Yeah.
The National Archives puts trigger warning on the Declaration of Independence. I would say qualifies. I've read many and before. Seattle voted whether or not to decriminalize crime.
Bill, the kind of people who do this came within an eyelash of reelecting Donald Trump with three words, defund the police, defund. And if you think that that's the craziest thing that progressives can come up with, you don't understand Will's law, which is there's no such thing as rock bottom.
Brilliant, and congratulations to both of them. And we look forward to talking to George Will on our show on Wednesday. This came in from Lewis in Longview, Washington. He says, Michael, the issue, I believe he assumes that we're talking about the vaccine mandate, okay? The issue is whether the government can dictate a vaccination or anything else. Businesses, et cetera, can dictate hiring or firing policies as long as they don't break constitutional laws. Where is the constitutional law specifying government dictates? Well, basically, there are government dictates all around us. You ever try to build a house? There are all kinds of laws that the local government, now it's not the federal government. And that's why the biggest constitutional issue, and this is what Alan Dershowitz said when he was on our show, biggest constitutional issue with vaccine mandates comes if they're declared federally. But right now, all 50 states have vaccine mandates where the government tells you, yes, you must vaccinate your kids with these following vaccines or they don't go to school. And it's something the anti-vaxxers have been complaining about for a long time. But the idea that this is not constitutional, a big question if it's all federal. But if it is state organized, which is why President Biden would have done so much better to actually work with the governors rather than to challenge them on this. And we will be getting to that, I suspect, and moving in that direction, I hope, as a country. Meanwhile, looking back at something that moved our country profoundly, there's a remarkable movie to celebrate the 20th anniversary of September 11th. Listen.
Now it's time for MedVed's Entertainment Minute.
A remarkable new documentary gives you an almost minute-by-minute sense of the unfolding horror of one of the most significant days in American history. It's called 9/11, Inside the President's War Room. Now streaming on Apple TV+.
September 11th, 2001.
We went from a calm, beautiful day to one in which our world changed dramatically.
That's President George W. Bush, in fact, who gave these filmmakers unique access, as did Vice President Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and most of the other important figures who played a role on that fateful day. Even though most Americans know what happened, this gorgeously made film uses the vivid emotional recollections of leading decision makers to recapture their own confusion and near panic in dealing with this devastating, unprecedented attack on American civilians. Some of the horror and immediacy of the footage of destruction at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon makes this definitely an adults-only experience. 4 stars for the extraordinary, unforgettable 9/11 Inside the President's War Room. And with dictates that our Lewis, our emailer, was asking about, there is a new dictate that we'll talk about on Tuesday, which is the major airlines are banning something on all flight, on all flights. They're doing it. It's not the government. What are they banning? We will get to that tomorrow. We'll also talk about, and this goes along with sounding like a headline in The Onion, a major university is now joining the so-called lowercase movement to fight against oppression. What does that mean? It means when they write out their university, which is 3 different words, there will be no capital letters. Under this new policy, capital letters will only be used when referring to the struggle for recognition of indigenous people. And speaking of struggle, there is an ongoing effort, and I salute it and I root for it with all my heart, to try to paint over some of Seattle's plague of graffiti everywhere. The people who are in charge of that say it's actually like a game of whack-a-mole, and the Taggers have won. And then a group of professors from top universities have gotten together to condemn the merit system as unjust because it rewards productive individuals. Uh-huh. And what's wrong with that? Well, we will explain all. Coming up next time in this greatest nation on God's green earth.